Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Bill Lofelm, whose new Maureen Coughlan novel is Let the Devil Out. We'll also hear from Beth Ann Patrick, the editor of The Books That Changed My Life, reflections by 100 authors, actors, musicians, and other remarkable people. Bill Lofelm is one of the best crime writers in New Orleans. His first two books, Fresh Kills and Bloodroot, were set in his native Staten Island. But after he found his footing in New Orleans, he moved his fictional policewoman Maureen Coughlan here. And some might say he and she have gone to the devil. The series started with The Devil She Knows, continued with The Devil in Her Way and Doing the Devil's Work, and now in his most recent Let the Devil Out, Maureen and Bill do just that. Bill Lofelm, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. It's good to be back.
Now, Maureen is in some big trouble in this book, isn't she?
She's made a bit of a mess for herself. Yeah, she has, and hasn't quite figured out how to wiggle out of it yet.
And she started dishing out some vigilante justice.
She is. She's officially off duty, but that hasn't stopped her from wielding her baton a little bit.
Keeping an eye on the people.
Yes.
Now, I think that's one of the great dilemmas that we face in detective series. The idea that the protagonists often know what is just and right and don't see it happening any other way and take the law into their own hands.
I think it's something she saw other officers do in different ways in the earlier books and something she's been tempted to do by herself.
And it's a great dilemma for all people, as you say. The whole idea of power in these books.
It is. I mean, I think everybody's had a situation in their life where they know what they're supposed to do or what the quote-unquote right thing is, and then they do something else because it's easier or better or think we'll get a result more in keeping with what they want. And it's true. I mean, one of the themes of all the Maureen books is power. Mm-hmm. And one of the things she struggled with since becoming a police officer is having some after living her whole life without having any.
And I have to say, as a woman reader, that is very satisfying. Now, one of the things I love what you've been doing with the characters in these books is that in addition to Preacher Boyd, her great mentor, you surround her with interesting women from all walks of life. You know, there's a detective that she's trying to model herself after. There's a street girl, Dice, that she keeps an eye on. She's chasing a woman named Madison Leary in this book. So you're creating a whole gallery of interesting women as you write these books.
That's kind of evolved just very naturally and trying to carve out a niche that I feel is original or somewhat unique. And I don't think there's a lot of crime fiction that's populated predominantly with women and to a certain degree people of color also in the books.
And there's some great revelations about Preacher Boyd in this book, who is one of the great recurring characters.
That was a surprise to me, too. It just kind of turned out that way.
Oh, readers, you are in for pleasure. I
mean, he's full of surprises, Preacher is.
Now, in this novel, Maureen's returning to work after a leave of absence. And after her apartment has been shot up, she's recovering from a lot of assaults on kind of every level. And she's determined to prove herself as cop, as a woman, as all kinds of things. But it's also important to her to be a New Orleanian, isn't it?
It is. She has finally found some place where she wants to belong. And so it's kind of working overtime to fit in. And I think it's a fun, it kind of reverses one of the tropes about crime fiction, I think, of the loner detective who always lives on the outside of everything. And I wanted to work with someone who's trying to get in as best and as fast as she can. She loves it here.
And I love it when she gets some props from her fellow officers. That really means the world to her.
It does. Being a police officer is a calling for her. And even though she struggles with how to be a good one, I mean, her heart is always in the right place.
I think so. Now, one of the interesting things about this as part of a series in crime fiction is that the NOPD is really under assault in this book in so many ways.
Yes. I think we're prone to, because of, and I think social media has added to this, but it's also true in traditional news media, and we're prone to binary thinking in arguments. It's us versus them. And I think this is part of the problem confronting policing in America, is it's become very us versus them. There's the police and there's everybody else. So I think part of your job as an artist and a writer is to bring the complications back into the argument. So all police are bad doesn't do anybody any good, you know, putting that idea out there. And just one of the things I've learned in researching the department, especially looking into the consent decree, is just how difficult it is to be a police officer and how kind of on their own they really are. And that contributes to this kind of us versus them mentality. Yeah.
And how dangerous their lives are on the streets. You really see that in this book.
I think so. The group that's after them is actually a real group that has a history of violence against law enforcement. Uh-huh. And it's something we've seen an uptick in recent years, is really domestic terror against law enforcement. And I think, again, people tend to point the argument in the wrong direction and say that the Black Lives Matter movement is a real threat to police officers. And it's like, that's not really who's physically endangering police officers. It's domestic terrorists. That is mostly white males. It's budget cuts. It's refusing to pay people and cutting their pensions. And there are all the many more extant threats to healthy policing than we are really paying attention to.
And you certainly mastered the art of the cliffhanger, man. I've got to tell you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. That really took some work.
Yes. And every book is starting to lead to the next so directly. So am I right in saying the next book will be set during Mardi Gras, maybe?
Yes, actually.
Yay.
Yes. I swore I would never write a Mardi Gras book. And a friend of mine a couple of years ago challenged me to it. He says, just write, find a side of Mardi Gras that nobody talks about. He's like, you've been a bartender for how many Mardi Gras? Talk about the people who have to throw the party manage the party and all the behind the scenes stuff. So that's really where that book goes. It's set actually during the Muses Parade.
Sweet.
Yes.
You know I like that.
I know.
Now, one of the other things in this book is this recurring refrain of preachers and of many of the police officers in this book. They end a lot of their conversations with the word believe. Which, you know, I think somebody could just write a great book about New Orleans on that subject. We believe in New Orleans, you know?
That's kind of preacher's little saying or salute or tagline. And the other officers used it. And that's kind of my way of showing his influence in the department. And you see even some of the more embittered or cynical officers still toss that word out because his influence on the 6th District has been so profound as a leader. And I think it's his way of keeping Maureen focused, and that you kind of try and do the next right thing and believe that you'll get the results you want. I think he's trying to push her away. She has a tendency towards shortcuts, legal and otherwise.
Right.
And he's kind of trying to make her less of a blunt instrument. You know, I think, I don't know, forget even if it's in this book or another book where he says you need to show a little finesse, and she just kind of laughs at him. She's like, you realize who you're speaking to.
Yeah,
and he's
right.
Like, well, you have to learn. And I think he wants to remind her of why she does what she does. Because he sees in her, you didn't become a police officer for the paycheck or for the pension. You became a police officer because you wanted to be part of something larger than yourself.
And more important than yourself, you know, in a way.
And so he just tries to remind her. And I think it's a word that he's taught the other officers that he's helped bring up to try and accomplish the same thing. I mean, I draw on a lot of my experience being a writer with her experience being a cop, that you found where you want to be and what you want to do and the people that you want to be around. And the flip side of that is you're always thinking, today is the day I get kicked out of the club. You know, today is the day they find out I don't really belong, that I'm not really supposed to be part of this, that I don't really have what it takes to stick around. Those same insecurities play on her. And I think that's also part of where the belief comes in.
Yep.
This believe in yourself.
I believe in you, Bill.
Well, thank you, Susan.
So how many books have you got in the pipeline now? How far ahead are you thinking?
In detail, not too far ahead. We have the next year's book is with my editor right now. And then I'm trying to think of where to go after that. I think we're going to see a bit of a time jump, maybe a year or so. And she's going to be doing more plainclothes work and out of uniform a little bit. One of the things I found out researching the Mardi Gras book is that New Orleans, the detective in the NOPD is not a rank. So she doesn't have to do 10, 15 years in the department before she can become a detective, you need some experience, obviously, and you need to prove that you're smart and you can do the job. But you can really be groomed by another more experienced detective, which is kind of already happening for her.
Lot to look forward to there.
Yes.
Oh, we've been talking with Bill Lofilm, whose new thriller, and I do mean thriller, is Let the Devil Out. You can meet him Tuesday, July 5th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. And Doing the Devil's Work is also new in paperback. Bill, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
I started shaking, I could hardly move even when I heard a man on my TV. Said somebody let the devil out. Somebody let the devil out.
I can already tell that Beth Ann Patrick, a.k.a. the Book Maven, is a kindred spirit. She's a writer, editor, and critic, and as she often says, above all, a reader. She's the author of An Uncommon History of Common Things with John Thompson and An Uncommon History of Common Courtesy. Today, we'll be talking about her new book, one that all readers are sure to love. It's The Books That Changed My Life, Reflections by 100 Authors, Actors, Musicians, and Other Remarkable People. Beth Ann, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. So great to be here. And I think you're right. We are kindred spirits.
Well, this is so much fun, this book. I feel like every book group should just buy this book and start working their way through it, you know, book by book.
Thank you. That is a great idea. I heartily endorse it. Go ahead, Book Groups of America.
Yes. So you begin in your introduction with the book that changed your life, which I thought was so important and was so interesting to hear.
The book that changed my life was a book that actually changed my life, not just a favorite book or a book that I love. And it's a 20th century novel called Silence by Shusaku Endo, a Japanese novelist. And the reason the book changed my life is because I was so excited when I was reading it, and I was talking at length to a friend who probably wanted to just discuss, you know, something fun about her, you know, her latest haircut, and I was going on and on and on, and she finally said, you know what, you really shouldn't be thinking about applying to law school. You should be going on to get an advanced degree in literature. And I actually did.
Now, that's a book that made a change, truly.
It did. It really did. And I thought, I wanted to ground the book in that experience, Susan, because I didn't want people to think that this was just another collection of, you know, wonderful books that people love and cherish. There are lots of those collections out there, and they're terrific. I have many of them. But this was different. This was really about books that changed things for people.
Right. Books with real consequences.
Yeah.
So how did you choose this Reading 100? I love the diversity of this group.
Well, I wish that I could say that I handpicked each and every one of my favorites, but let's face it, I would have started with President Obama if that had been the case. And that is not to diss anyone in the book, that's just to say, but I really wanted to make sure that there was a diversity of voices, and I meant all kinds of voices, everything from gender diversity to ethnic diversity to geographical diversity, and also in things that people did. So I don't just speak to authors. I also speak to other remarkable people, as the subtitle calls it, you know, musicians and chefs and actors and people that you wouldn't normally think of as being book focused, like CEOs and politicians. One of my favorite interviews is with Tommy Hilfiger, because he talks about being dyslexic and how that has led him to choosing books very carefully, because if he decides to give his time to reading, reading is difficult for him, and he wants to make sure that it's worth it. And I think that is an amazing message to get out to young people, because so many people do have different kinds of challenges, and doesn't mean that you can't be a reader.
And I love that the book he said changed his life was Steve Jobs by Walter Isaacson.
Yes, really terrific choice. And it did change his life. It gave him new ideas about how to be a CEO, how to be an executive, how to run his business. You know, people who responded to me, people who saw this pitch or got a call from me or an email really lived up to the challenge. I didn't get many people who were just reciting things off the cuff. They cared. These are readers. And for instance, Melissa Rivers, Joan Rivers' daughter, I thought, well, you know, gosh, I don't know that much about her. Who knows? Maybe she's going to give me a little canned PR speech. But instead, she gave me a lovely story about how Joan Rivers used to read to her every night, and their favorite story was The Story of Ferdinand by Monroe Leaf. This is one of the sweetest children's books you can imagine. It's the last one you would probably associate with Joan Rivers.
I know. That was really adorable. And I was also surprised by Tim Gunn's choice. That came out of left field for me. I thought, wow.
Let us now praise famous men. Yes, it was a very serious choice, a very grave choice. And most of the people in the book were interviewed by me, and then I wrote up the essays. But Tim Gunn did write his own, which really impressed me. There were just a handful who chose to write their own, and he was one of them. It wasn't because he thought, oh, my voice is just matchless. You know, it was because he took that book quite seriously and it really meant something to him.
Now, some are a little bit expected. When Chef Kat Cora mentions her choice, that didn't surprise me at all.
You know, it's funny to know that some of the people were actually choosing books that were, as you say, quite expected, you know, something that you would actually think that they would read. For instance, Jodi Picoult talking about Gone with the Wind. But with Kat Cora, she did choose a book about food. And I loved that because MFK Fisher, it's not a cookbook. The Art of Eating is real literature. And so I thought, even though it was expected, it had the spirit of the book in it.
And there was such an elegance in that choice, I think,
yes.
You know?
Oh, well, prose is the best. And I thought, oh, gosh, Cora's a reader. She writes cookbooks that are extremely accessible and very popular, but she is truly a reader.
And Kate Mulgrew, the actress.
Oh, what a wonderful choice of Edna O'Brien's book. And also, what a wonderful choice just to talk with her. I was just thrilled. Another reader, someone who really loves literature, but for her, A Pagan Place was, again, a book that changed her and that made her see that there was a different way out there. And it's funny because we think of Kate Mulgrew as such an Irish sort of redheaded actress, but, I mean, she's from Iowa. She's not from a place like Ireland at all. And Edna O'Brien is the quintessential Irish novelist. So people relate to things in books in such funny ways. And that's another thing I loved about speaking to these 100 people is even when they were choosing something that might be, you know, expected from their background or from their profession or from their family heritage, they still had some little twist. There was some, you know, interesting reason why they specifically related to that book.
And the other thing that was so surprising is that so few books were repeated as choices.
Oh, I'm so glad, Susan, that you picked up on that. That's one of my favorite things. And I have to tell you, the reason it's one of my favorite things is that no one knew anyone else's choices. I did not say, gosh, Gone with the Wind has been picked. You can't choose that. I let this come up in our conversations. And sometimes I let it come up just naturally and people thought of things on their own. And sometimes I had to talk with them a little bit and dig down deeper. But we only have one book that's mentioned twice, and that's The God of Small Things by Arundhati Roy. And the two people who chose that, novelists both, Sunil Yapa and Meera Jacob, chose it for different reasons, but both reasons are quite personal. But yes, that's the only one that was repeated.
And it's obvious that Sunil Yapa was really influenced by that book. I adore his book too, don't you?
Isn't his book amazing? It's one of the finest of 2016. It really is.
And as you might suspect, a few folks refuse to settle for just one book, like Fran Lebowitz and Eric Idle.
Yes. How fortunate am I to have those two in my book? Oh, my goodness. When they agreed, Eric Idle was one of the people who wrote his own piece, and I'm awfully glad that he did, and no spoilers. People have to read it. It's very, very much in the Eric Idle vein.
Yes.
But I did get to speak with Fran Lebowitz, which was a huge treat and honor. And, you know, as you said, she just can't choose one book. Her life is books. All she does is buy books. She's had an apartment customized for her books. She's the book maven, not I.
Now, we should also say that this book benefits a very worthy cause as well.
Yes, I'm thrilled to say that the book's profits will go in part to 826 National, which is the literacy foundation and charity founded by Dave Eggers, the novelist. Of course, people in Nolens will recognize him from his book Zeitung, which is not without its controversy. However, Eggers has done a great deal of good all around the United States. And these are centers. They're very fun. Each one has a different theme. And they help students, mostly junior high and high school students, to learn not just about writing and finding their own voices, but also about producing something. You know, kids go through a workshop at an 826 outpost, and they come away with a book or an album or a chapbook. They learn a little bit about the publishing process and what it's like to have that pride of authorship when you finish something. And that's a really amazing gift to be giving our young people. So I'm really thrilled to be in partnership with them on this title.
Well, it's a great, great cause. We've been talking with Beth Ann Patrick about the books that changed my life, Reflections by 100 Authors, Actors, Musicians, and Other Remarkable People. You can meet her Tuesday, June 28th at 6 at Octavia Books. Beth Ann, I really look forward to seeing you. Thank you so much.
I look forward to meeting you, Susan, and thank you. What a pleasure it's been to speak with you today.
I wasn't always a sucker for dog stories. My crazy dog lady conversion began 16 years ago with a puppy named Bob, who was the biggest symptom of my midlife crisis. Bob was followed by a golden husky mix named Charlie, and now I'm the personal assistant to two golden retrievers, Wilson and Bella. So when a good story comes along, fiction or non, I'm ready. Novelist Paul Stutonghi turns his gifts to nonfiction in Dog Gone, A Lost Pet's Extraordinary Journey and the Family Who Brought Him Home. The story ostensibly begins in October 1998 when Fielding Marshall is hiking the Appalachian Trail with a friend and his dog Gonker takes off into the wild. You know how fast a dog can be. You know the sinking terror that follows such a moment. But add to that the terrible responsibility of knowing that your dog has Addison's disease and needs medicine to survive. Paul Stutonghi takes us back into the history of the Marshall family, describing how a sweet, abused little girl, Virginia Marshall, found solace in a puppy, then lost him to her father's carelessness. That wasn't going to happen to her son, Fielding. So she gets to work searching for Gonker, and thankfully, the title telegraphs the happy ending, but it's the getting there that's amazing. The story of the family's love and perseverance, the kindness of strangers along the way, the incredible respect people feel for dogs and the human-canine bond. It made me cry, in a good way. You'll love it too, and you'll be glad that Gonker has achieved a bit of literary immortality. Of course, not all dog stories have happy endings. Loving a dog brings with it vulnerability, the certainty of loss, but so much love in between. Stephen Rowley's first novel, Lily and the Octopus, is just such a story. One day, Ted Flask looks down at his aging dachshund Lily to discover that there's an octopus attached to her head. And so begins a terrible battle against cancer. Rowley began this book after his real dog Lily died, and it is such a love story, sad and sweet. It's warm and funny, too, and Ted's conversation with Lily will strike a chord with anyone who's ever lived alone with a dog. Ted, at his sister's wedding, considers his relationship with Lily. I think of how dogs are witnesses, how they are present for our most private moments, how they are there when we think of ourselves as alone. They witness our quarrels, our fears, and all of our secret behaviors that we have to hide from our fellow humans. They witness without judgment. There was a book once about a man who tried to teach his dog to speak a human language to help him solve his wife's murder. It said that if dogs could tell us all they have seen, it would magically stitch together all the gaps in our lives. I try to witness this moment how a dog would witness it, to take it all in. Meg Rosoff is a brilliant writer of novels for young adults. Her first novel for grown-ups, Jonathan Unleashed, is a quirkily charming and very wise story about the way dogs lead us where we need to go. Jonathan Trefoil reluctantly agrees to dog-sit his brother's border collie Dante and cocker spaniel Sissy for 6 months. And in that time, his entire life changes. When his girlfriend Julie moves in and wants to get married for the sake of a magazine photo shoot, he keeps calling the wedding the funeral. That's a bad sign. Meltdowns at Jonathan's dead-end job start happening, despite the fact that Dante and Sissy have become office mascots. Eventually, finding a way to use his creative gifts, finding a woman who will really love him for the sweet, crazy man he is, those priorities rightfully move to the top of the list, thanks to the presence of Dante and Sissy. Never has a book so sweetly shown how smart it is to insist on one thing in a human relationship. Love me, love my dogs. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guest, Beth Ann Patrick, signs The Books That Changed My Life, Tuesday, June 28th at 6 at Octavia Books. Christine Audler signs her children's book, What Lou Can Do, Thursday, June 30th at 11 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. John Pope signs Getting Off at Elysian Fields, Obituaries from the New Orleans Times-Picayune, Saturday, July 2nd at noon at Barnes & Noble Mandeville. Today's guest, Bill Lofelm, signs Let the Devil Out, Tuesday, July 5th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. And coming up, John Gregory Brown signs 1,000 Miles from Nowhere, Thursday, July 7th at 6 at Octavia Books. Jean Redman, writing as R. Jean Reed, signs her new mystery, Roots of Murder, Friday, July 8th at 6 at Tubby & Coo's Mid-City Bookshop. Chuck Palahniuk signs his book, Fight Club 2, Monday, July 11th at 4 at Garden District Bookshop. Tickets must be purchased at Eventbrite. This is a signing only, no performance. Neil Bascom discusses and signs The Winter Fortress, the epic mission to sabotage Hitler's atomic bomb, Tuesday, July 12th from 5 to 7:30 at the National World War II Museum. And don't forget that July 4th weekend brings the Essence Music Festival to town, that party with a purpose. Among the authors scheduled to appear are Melissa Harris-Perry, Julianne Malveaux, Misty Copeland, Ayanla Van Zandt, and Terry McMillan. Check out Essence.com for complete information. And as we move into July, don't forget that all our public libraries are offering summer reading programs, and it's not too late to take part in story time, Zumba classes, nature safaris, writing workshops, you name it. Visit one of your cool local branches for a fine summer break. And all of July is devoted to celebrating the search for Waldo, the popular storybook character who's hiding in uptown area businesses. Pick up a passport at any of the 23 participating local businesses, gather store stamps or signatures from at least 10 or up to 18, then bring your stamp passport to Octavia Books. There will be a grand Waldo celebration July 31st at 2 at Octavia Books. Other participating businesses include Toast, Blue Frog Chocolates, Crescent City Comics, Dat Dog, Dirty Coast, Magic Box, National Art and Hobby, Britannia Theater, Scriptura, as well as many others. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.